Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
And I'm going to begin by asking the first question, and I'm going to try to set the good example here and keep my question under 30 seconds as well. So I believe that both of you would agree that somehow objective moralities are superior to subjective moralities. And the one thing I learned about myself tonight was that just like Steve Pinker, I must be a non-objective moralist. And so the question I want to ask is, what is the fundamental basis by which we as human beings can know morality as objective?
You remember that I said that moral philosophy is distinguished or subdivided into a number of different subfields like moral semantics, moral epistemology, and moral ontology. Our focus tonight has been on moral ontology, but Dr. Goodwin's question concerns moral epistemology. That is, how do we know these moral truths if there are objective truths? How do we come to grasp them? And we haven't really talked about that tonight. That hasn't been the burden of my case to argue anything about how it is that we come to know these truths. But I would be open to various theories for how we might come to a knowledge of moral truths. I think, as a theist, that God has constituted us with a certain moral faculty that enables us to grasp objective moral truths, the difference between right and wrong, and he has so crafted our cognitive faculties that we have a moral sense. In addition to that, I think that by grasping the intrinsic value of human beings, that human beings do have intrinsic and inherent worth, we can then use reason to deduce certain moral duties and obligations for how we ought to treat other people by recognizing that we need to treat them as ends in themselves rather than as means to an end. So given the intrinsic value of human beings, you can then rationally work out whether or not, for example, you ought to steal your neighbor's car from his garage or something of that sort, for which we have no explicit divine command, but which would fall under these general moral truths that would follow from how we treat people as ends in themselves. And I think divine revelation can also be a source of moral knowledge. I think that God reveals himself to us in various ways that can tell us moral truths that could not be deduced simply by reason alone, or which are not built into our moral sense. So all of those would be different ways in which we might come to know objective moral truths.
Thank you. Dr. Anthony, follow?
Yeah, I think it's another area where it's okay. I think this is, I agree with Dr. Craig that this is a different issue than the one that we have been concerned with. I think it's a really fascinating question. It's a question not just for philosophers, but for psychologists and ethologists and evolutionary biologists as well. How it is that we come to have the faculty that we think of as a conscience. It's quite clear that cross-culturally, as I was saying, some of the data that I was citing, cross-culturally, children develop a moral conscience along the same developmental timetable, and interestingly enough, a moral conscience that has some of the same features, irrespective of the culture in which the child was brought up. And one of the most robust features of this innate sense of morality is a capacity for distinguishing between the dictates of an authority and what the child perceives as right or wrong, independently of what they're told is right or wrong. They can make that distinction. They do make that distinction. And this is true even of children that are taught to believe that there is a God and that God issues only good commands. I certainly think that the problem of moral epistemology is a difficult one, but I think it's only made way more difficult if you bring God into the picture, particularly if you think about all the different understandings there are of God, all the different texts and scriptures that people at different places around the world and at different times have regarded as sacred and as the record of God's will. My own view is that God could have been a little more explicit and maybe used a language that everybody understood and not just a small group of people in the Middle East. But in any case, it is an interesting question how we come to know these things, and I think some of the things that Dr. Craig mentioned are certainly involved. I think that when we realize about ourselves that we set ends, that we conceive projects, and that we value those projects, and then we determine through observation and reason that other creatures on the planet are just like we are, then we have a basis for making the leap that Kant talked about, and generalizing, seeing that if we give ourselves rules about right behavior, this is something that we have to think of as binding on all people.
Thank you.
Okay.
Because the next question is for you. We'll go to this microphone.
Okay. I thought I had a monopoly on Dr. Anthony, but it seems that I have a tail following me, so I'll keep my question shorter than I at first was going to have it. Dr. Anthony, first of all, thank you for a stimulating, honest, sincere debate tonight. Please correct me if I'm wrong. It appears to me that in your view, you can have acts that are simply wrong, and that is the stopping point, whereas we couldn't have God as simply good not in virtue, but by the virtue of having done acts. Does it not appear to be a better explanation with more explanatory scope and power to have an infinite being in whom these things are grounded rather than finite things that you can think are in themselves simply good or bad?
Okay, I'm not denying that if there were a supremely good being, if there were such a being, that might be a sufficient basis. But what I'm saying is it's the goodness of that being and not the fact that it's God. And so what you need for there to be objective moral facts is objective moral facts. If it's the goodness of a divine being, that's an objective moral fact. If it's the objective badness of causing suffering to creatures that experience suffering, that's an objective moral fact. Dr. Craig and I agree that there are fundamental moral facts. I don't see that it detracts from the existence of fundamental moral facts for God not to exist. And by the way, it's not the contingent existence of the creatures that feel pain that is the moral fact. The moral fact is that if there are creatures that feel pain, then you must not cause unnecessary pain. That's a necessary truth. That's true in all possible worlds. It's true before there were any sentient creatures. It will remain true if there cease to be sentient creatures.
Thank you.
I think the question is a good one, and I noticed that whereas Dr. Anthony is willing to simply stop with certain moral facts like if there are sentient creatures, it's wrong to cause them pain, but she seems to demand an explanation for why one should think that God is good and is the basis of moral values, and that seems to me to be rather odd. The very concept of God is that of a being which is worthy of worship. So,
thanks. And now a question for Dr. Craig.
First, thank you, Dr. Craig, and of course, Dr. Anthony, for a fantastic debate. But I just hope we can go back to the Euthyphro question for a moment. I'm having some difficulty understanding your resolution of the Euthyphro challenge. I'm not sure how the distinction you draw between ontological and semantic ethics. I'm not sure how that leaves any place for God to do ethical work. Because let's say we have a complete explanation of the semantics of the good for the moment. Let's say that issue is settled. We have an account. what does it do to say that there exists an X such that it instantiates perfectly all of those things which we have established in our semantic account of the good, or constitutive of what we say the good is? Especially since it seems to be a part of the semantics of the good that they are, that the good is normative. What does it do to say that there is some perfect instantiation of the good greater than which nothing can be conceived?
Okay. The role that God plays in this would be to provide an ontological foundation for thinking that there are objective moral values. But it doesn't play a semantical role in defining the concept of the good. Giving a semantics for the meaning of the English word good doesn't do anything to show that there are such properties as goodness, or that it really exists. So that it's quite distinct. You can understand the concept or the definition of the word good without understanding what its ontological foundation is. Let me give an analogy from physics. Take light, for example. We know that light is a certain range of electromagnetic radiation. That's the nature of light. But that is not a semantical thesis about the meaning of the word light. People were able to use the word light meaningfully long before they knew anything about its nature. And similarly, they knew the difference between light and darkness before they knew anything about its nature. So what I'm suggesting is that it's similar with God. God provides an analysis of what it is for something to be good, and then also right and wrong. But it's not the definition of the word any more than the definition of the word light is a certain range of electromagnetic radiation.
Thanks.
I think that's a very good point. I'd like to say something about the way in which natures are supposed to explain things. The nature of water is H2O. We know that water is constituted, that is, by these atoms bonded in a certain way, or these molecules bonded in a certain way. And it's true that people knew perfectly well what the meaning of water was before they knew that it was H2O. However, H2O explains all the properties that we use to pick out water, and that we used to pick out water before as water before we knew what it was. Now, Dr. Craig keeps stipulating that God has a good nature. And if you ask further, well, what is it to have a good nature? Well, it's to be God. Now, that to me says that whatever God was like, whatever choices he were to have made, those would have been the good ones, because God is stipulated to be good. This is not a nature that's going to explain anything. It's not going to explain, God's being good is not going to explain why it's wrong to torture sentient creatures. So it doesn't bear the same relationship to our judgments, our ordinary pre-theoretic judgments about what the good is, that the fact that water is H2O bears to our understanding of what water is.
Hey, Dr. Anthony. Hey, I was just curious. You began to talk about your experience in college, sort of this process of losing faith, and I was wondering if that was more of a, was it a purely a thought process, or were there some experiences contributing to that, to deciding?
It was entirely the result of my first philosophy class, where I thought about the arguments for God, for the existence of God, and I fought tooth and nail to defend them, and I just found that they were not convincing to me. The ontological argument that Dr. Craig has been kind of alluding to, that God is a being greater than which none can be conceived, I just didn't see how some fact about what I'm able to conceive, to conjure up, was supposed to demonstrate that something actually existed, for example. And then I hit the argument from evil, and I couldn't maintain it anymore. It seemed to me so obvious that a perfectly good being could not have set things up the way they were, that I just found I didn't believe.
Now, Dr. Craig, I'm not sure it's quite fair to ask you to comment on Dr. Anthony's experiences in college, but you're welcome to reply if you wish.
Let me say something about my own experience. My faith journey was quite in the opposite direction. I was not raised in a Christian family or church-going home, but it was in high school that I began to think about the big questions in life, and one that tortured me was the meaning of my existence. I understood what science told me about the eventual fate of the universe and of the human race and of my own life. And in light of that inevitable extinction, it just seemed to me that life was meaningless and purposeless. And I later discovered that people like Nietzsche and Sartre and other existentialist philosophers had written and thought exactly the same way. And so when someone first shared with me the love of God that could be known in the person of Jesus Christ, this was just a revolution and a revelation to me. The idea that God loved me was something that was just shattering and new to me. And so I began to read the New Testament. I had never read it before. And as I did, I sensed there the ring of truth and a wisdom that I had never encountered before. And eventually I did come to faith and it changed my life. And as for the arguments for the existence of God, I found these to be very helpful and persuasive. I think tonight there's been an argument for God's existence lurking in the background, a kind of moral argument, namely, if God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist, but objective moral values do exist. On that, at least we both agree, from which it logically follows, therefore God exists. So I think that what we've been talking about tonight can actually provide moral grounds for believing in God's existence.
Thank you.
Thank you both. I don't go to this school, so I don't really have this opportunity. This was really great. My question is kind of a two-part question. You quoted Dawkins earlier in saying that there is a bottom, it's all meaningless, there is no purpose. And he says that, you know, the physical description of the universe points to that directly. And doesn't that give us more of a responsibility to take actions into our own hands and morality to be a part of our nature? And I mean, if God did exist and we're his children, don't you think he would want us to grow up and be responsible for ourselves anyway?
Well, yes, if he did exist, I agree with that. But the other part, no, I would agree with Dawkins when Dawkins says we're just machines for propagating DNA. So that on an atheistic view, there is no purpose, there is no responsibility. Responsible to what?
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
We put the responsibility of morality, as we've talked about tonight, in the hands of an omniscient being who we are unsure of its existence, yet we are completely aware of each other's existence.
Sure.
And why can't we be the ones that are responsible for our own actions?
Well, the question is, responsible to whom? You see, on atheism, as I said, there is no moral accountability. There is no ultimate responsibility on atheism, and eventually, we'll all die anyway. So, who was it? It was Steve who read the thing, "What has posterity done for me lately?" You know, this is, I think, a very poignant question for the atheist to ask. So, I guess it's just very hard for me to see why on atheism we would have these sort of moral responsibilities and objective duties rather than say we're just a primate that has evolved on this planet, and so why not just live for yourself rather than for others?
Well, can I just answer that real quick? If God didn't exist, then this is the only life we have, so that's why there would be morals, to make the best of this we possibly can.
See, how do you think that follows? If there is no God, then this is all that we have, but then nothing follows about how we should behave.
No, of course not.
Three parts is our limit, but we're very happy to have you on our campus today.
Can I say something? Yeah.
Yeah, please.
I think you're a very wise young man. I think, you know, the universe has no purpose, but I do, right? I have lots of purposes. Right? I have a book I want to write. I have children that I love and a husband that I love that I would do anything for. I have friends that are very dear to me. There are injustices in the world that I want to see corrected. I have lots of purposes. It makes a lot of difference to a lot of people and to me what I do. That gives my life significance. And I don't understand why, I'm worried for Dr. Craig. I wonder if he has any friends. I mean, don't you feel that your friend's well-being gives you purposes, that it gives your life some significance? if I were to sacrifice my life for my children, as I hope I would have the courage to do, the only thing that would make it insignificant is if my children's lives are insignificant. And boy, you'd better not say that.
But Louise, on atheism, they are insignificant.
Not
we're
to
all
me.
We're no, not you, but that's just subjective.
Sorry.
We're
it's
just
an
like
objective fact.
Okay.
It's an objective fact that they're significant to me. And if there's anybody
yeah,
on
you.
The planet to whom anything is significant, that's a fact that has moral significance that I need to take account of.
And I want you to know I'm now a friend of Bill, so.
Oh.
Dr. Antony, you mentioned earlier that oftentimes it's hard to do the moral thing. And I'm wondering, what is the atheistic explanation for a struggle like that to exist? Why would it be hard for human beings to do what is moral?
Well, because it makes you sometimes do things you don't want to do. Like, as I was writing this paper and writing all this stuff about not torturing animals and sentient beings, I thought, well, I make a point of eating free-range meat and buying humanely slaughtered animals, but I don't know where the restaurants that I eat at get their stuff, so I have to not eat meat in restaurants. Let me tell you, I love food. I love food, and I love going to restaurants, and I really like the taste of lamb, and I really like pork well prepared and so forth. I think I'm going to have to stop doing that. Now that's on the scale of difficult moral choices, an easy one, right? That's not a big deal. People lose their lives. Rachel Corrie, a 23-year-old American woman, went to the Gaza Strip to try to stop home demolitions from happening. Illegal, immoral home demolitions. She was crushed by a bulldozer. She gave up her life. Now, sorry, I think that is incredibly significant. And I think she had enormous courage. Goes beyond anything I can do, I'm sure. And she did it because she was outraged by the injustice. So that's hard.
Well, I think it's hard to be moral because so often moral the moral thing runs contrary to what self-interest prescribes. And so you have, on the one hand, this evolutionary principle of survival of the fittest. On the other hand, you have this moral ethic of compassion. And on the atheistic view especially, these are contrary to each other because survival of the fittest says, go for number one, climb to the top. The fit will survive, and that is just at odds with an ethic of compassion. And so the dilemma the naturalist faces is why should he deny what evolution has programmed into him to that the fit should survive and instead adopt this moral perspective? Why should Dr. Antony on naturalism not eat lamb when wolves eat lambs and do nothing immoral to the lamb? Why is it wrong for her to be carnivorous, but it's not wrong for the wolf to be carnivorous? I can't see any basis on naturalism for that. But on theism, I do want to say I think we do have responsibility toward animals and toward plants and the ecosystem, not because they are moral agents, but because on theism we are, and there have a creation mandate from God to steward the earth and to care for his creation. God, in the story of Adam and Eve, set man and woman upon this planet as husbandmen to garden or to care for the earth and the environment. So I think theism does give us a good basis for an environmental ethic that on naturalism and survival of the fittest, I just can't see any basis for.
Hey, great debate. I was just wondering, is it morally permissible to do something that most people would consider immoral, like to kill someone or commit genocide, like in the Bible? If you think that God told you to do it, like if you had a mental disorder, like schizophrenia, if you thought God had told you to do something.
We haven't talked about that tonight, and that's a very complicated issue on which a whole lot has been written, but I want to refer you to an article on my website that deals with this. It's question number 16 in the question archive where it deals with the this question of whether or not God could command things like genocide or Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac and how we're to understand that. And so to try to deal with that here in 1 minute would just be inadequate, but I have written a link on that on my website, question number 16 in the archive. Take a look at that if you're interested.
Yeah, I think it's a big problem how you're supposed to distinguish the commands of a God who, you know, because of the historical record, does command genocide from time to time, does tell people to wipe out every living thing, does tell a father to slaughter his son as a sacrifice and then says, never mind, does enter into a bet with the devil to see if he can test his faithful servant Job. So you know that God does do things like that, so it's kind of an epistemological problem what God is actually telling you to do. Now, the people that I know who are religious and sincerely moral people will say things like, look, those were stories written by primitive people. What they're doing is they're taking their independent sense of what's right and wrong, and they're using that as a guide to what God commands. We can all think of the good as what God would command if we mean by God a perfectly good being. But we can think of good in that way without God actually having to exist. We can use that as a sort of regulative ideal about what we're imagining the good is.
So, as we go on, I'll just point out that we're more than 2 hours into the evening and there are still 200 people in the room, which tells us something about the importance of the question that you all are discussing tonight. We'll try to go on for a little while longer, as long as it feels like people aren't falling over in the seats. But we would ask you to, if we can, just do whatever we can to keep up the pace, so we want to get as many people an opportunity as possible.
All right, now I'm going to feel bad because I have kind of a two-part question. Dr. Antony, most of your arguments stem from the fact that morality is based on sentience. Because I can confirm my existence, you can confirm your existence. Stealing from you would be wrong, and you stealing from me would also be wrong.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you just said. What would be wrong?
Like stealing. Okay. Like if I were to steal something from you. The first part of the question is, what would you consider like the least evolved? I apologize for that. The least evolved sentient being.
The
just
least
really quickly.
Of all sentient
least evolved.
Least evolved,
yeah. If just really quickly, I don't want to take
sure
up as much time.
I'm not sure what you mean by least evolved.
Like
everything that's on the planet has undergone evolution. Their ancestry's gone through an evolutionary change.
All right, fair enough. But like, say if I were to say that a squirrel or a rabbit was not sentient, and then something like me was sentient, what in the like absence of God? What creates that sentience, therefore morality?
Sentience is a matter of the complexity of the particular form of the system.
Yeah,
I'm not a biologist, I'm perfectly happy.
And see, that raises the question, how is having a certain complex nervous system the foundation for saying that, therefore, this is morally valuable, that this is a good? Your question about the least evolved sentient being, I think, is a good one, because I think you're asking is, where is the lower threshold where, you know, moral value breaks off and neutrality begins, and what sort of
oysters.
Basis would that?
Pardon me?
Oysters. So I think that you're raising a good question. It just seems to me to be arbitrary to think that sentience is objectively good, on atheism, at least.
Okay, I hope I have an easy question for you. It's a yes or no question.
Excellent.
So it should be kind of quick. Dr. Craig, if I understood you correctly, you asked the question of Dr. Antony. You asked her to answer this question. If there is no God, what sets human beings apart from other animals? Why should we follow any code of morality when ants and sharks and other animals clearly do not? What reasons do we have to consider ourselves above certain acts that other animals take part in? Well, I ask of you, isn't the fact that we as humans can conceive of a higher power, the fact that we have an ability to believe in God, isn't that enough?
No.
Thank you.
Is there a yes or no response on your part, Dr. Anthony?
Well, insofar as it as the capacity to do that probably entails the other capacities that I think are all significant. I forgot how the question was worded. I think my answer is yes.
Hi. I know that physicists and chemists, they formulate hypotheses about universes with different fundamental constants. I was just wondering if you could imagine a universe with like different sets of morality, or like morality with more invariant than like gravity.
I think there are some moral obligations that we have that are socially constructed, like property rights. I think that property rights are rights that are constructed by our agreement to form a social contract with each other. But I think that the fact that if a being is sentient, you can recognize the fact you have an obligation not to cause that sentient being unnecessary pain, I think that's a necessary truth. I wanted to just, while we're on that, I just wanted to say something about this question about why it isn't immoral for wolves to eat lambs. It's because wolves have no capacity for understanding moral obligation. They don't meet the preconditions for having moral obligations. They have some moral rights because they're sentient. They have a right not to be harmed by beings that know that they're harming them. But wolves don't have the capacity to recognize the moral facts, so they don't have the obligation. That's the difference between us and wolves.
Wait, now that just strikes me as really bizarre. You think that wolves have the right not to be harmed by a being which knows what it's doing if it harms the wolf, or that the lamb has a right not to be eaten by a being that has the knowledge of what it's doing, which the wolf doesn't have.
I don't think lambs have a right not to be eaten. I think they have a right not to be caused gratuitous pain.
Okay, that's incredible to me. How on a naturalistic, atheistic view would lambs and wolves and things like that have these sorts of rights? It just strikes me that there's just nothing in the naturalistic picture that would make us think that it just seems to me to be
faith. Suppose that's so. There's nothing in the naturalistic picture that makes it the case that I have a duty not to torture a lamb. Okay. Now God comes and says, "Don't torture a lamb." I don't see how anything has changed except that now the creator of the universe, who can commit me to eternal flames, has told me he doesn't want me to do it. Now I have some additional information, and it's going to structure my incentives. I don't see how any moral fact is created.
Dr. Craig, this might be another question 16, but you said that God's nature determines what is good, and his commands come down to us in that way, so that's how we can tell what's good and what's not. Well, that's helpful if we have one idea of God and an agreed upon set of commandments that we need to obey. But the reality is that there's multiple faiths in the world that have absolute truths that are not negotiable with each other. And they end up fighting each other over these truths. And you can have a non-religious person say that slavery is wrong while watching these two religious groups fight over issues of slavery if they're part of their faith. And so in the end, we end up choosing the faith or the non-faith based on the comparisons of these from our own standpoint. And so does that complicate the issue of God being necessary for morality when in fact there's so many different kinds of morality that exist?
No, I don't think it complicates the issue of God being necessary for morality as the ontological foundation for morality. What you're talking about is now again moral epistemology. How do we know the content of the good? How do we know what is right and wrong? And here I agree with Dr. Anthony. I think that semantically we know the meaning of moral terms and sentences without defining them in terms of God. And I think epistemologically we don't need to believe in God in order to know certain things are right and things are wrong or good and evil. So issues of moral epistemology and semantics are quite distinct from the reality of moral values and duties. Now, this does underline the importance, I think, though, what you're saying, of being sure that we believe in the right God, because certainly there are religions with concepts of God that are, I think, quite inadequate. And so this does underline the very important question of, well, which God is the true God? And that, I suppose, is a debate for another evening.
Dr. Anthony, the basis for your morality, if I understand it, is primarily whether something causes suffering.
No.
No, okay.
Sorry, the basis for my morality is the objective moral facts. One of them is that it's wrong to cause a sentient creature suffering. I think that, you know, that's pretty comprehensive.
How do you determine what the objective moral facts are?
Well, we do it by testing our reactions to certain kinds of possibilities, thinking about the principles that those reactions might entail, testing those principles about against new cases, pretty much the way we find out about anything.
Okay. So I have a sort of a continuation of what my original question was. You didn't give me the answer I expected, but I'll continue it. It's still relevant. Why?
That's a sneaky philosophy.
Why would you pick one, for instance, one moral standard over another? For instance, why would you decide that the principle that is wrong causes suffering as one of your principles? Why would you pick that over, say, the principle, I could choose the principle, anything is wrong which does not cause me the greatest amount of pleasure. Why pick, what is an objective standard by which you would choose these principles?
Well, I'm not sure what kind of an answer you're looking for. It seems to me that if I were to say anything that causes me suffering is wrong, but I don't care about the suffering of other people, that seems a morally arbitrary position to take. If there's something about me that makes my pleasure morally important, and I see that there are other beings that are constituted as I do, that experience pleasure, it seems like it's a kind of inconsistency to not think that their pleasure is important to them too, and that's a fact I have to take account of. Are you tempted by this view?
No.
Why not?
Am I tempted by?
Are you tempted to think that, does it strike you as a view you need to consider that maybe the morally right thing to do is to just do things that benefit?
No, I'm just using that as an example.
So why aren't you tempted?
I don't know. Can I just continue this very quickly?
Okay, I'd like to ask you to move on to the next question. Thank you, though.
Okay. You commented on speciesism and how atheists and Dr. Anthony is being specious. By saying rape is wrong for humans, but let's say not necessarily for sharks, if God is necessary for morality. Why isn't it being a specious saying that God only cares about humans and what they do, or that what makes human morality more important than other creatures if God made them all? And if it's a soul that makes humans follow this, that makes humans do this? Or
I didn't catch that last part.
Soul.
Oh.
If it's a soul, then isn't God kind of being a specious by only giving human souls and not other creatures?
Did you say that he's being capricious by
specious.
Not
specious?
Specious.
Is it?
Oh, he's guilty of speciesism. No, not at all. I mean, what speciesism is thinking that your own species is somehow invested with objective moral worth, when in fact, you're no different from all the others. It's kind of like racism, you know, thinking that your race is somehow privileged and special and the others aren't. But if, for example, human beings are made in the image of God, that is to say they are persons, as God is personal, and they have a soul and are moral free agents, then they are very different from sharks and zebras and lions and so forth. there are objective differences between human beings and non-personal creatures. Now, if there were a person who had a shark body, say, then that person, I think, would have moral obligations that would be given to that person by God. So the physical body isn't the important thing. It's whether or not we're dealing here with persons who have those same qualities that God exhibits and therefore are intrinsically valuable.
I'm not exactly saying it's the body itself. It's just what makes that only humans, the personal creatures, what makes them more important just because they can comprehend it, but why wouldn't other creatures be able to comprehend it if God isn't necessarily remarking that they are more important?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Did you say why aren't other creatures able to comprehend it?
Why would God make that so?
Well, I think ultimately, now this is, again, this is just my personal opinion. I think that these serve the purpose of having an ecosystem that is one in which human beings can flourish and ultimately come to know God and to be members of his kingdom and part of his family, and that these are also a reflection of the beauty and the creativity of God himself. I think God is a sort of supreme artist, and his beauty is reflected in the creation, so he delights in the abundance of creatures that exist in the universe. And these serve as a kind of arena in which this human drama is then played out.
So sometimes arbitrary decisions are both needed and justified, and I am going to let you respond. Okay. I'm just going to say that we are going to stop at 10 o'clock, and I say that because we've asked a lot of our panelists tonight, and I say it out loud because the people at the end of those lines may be very upset with me in 10 minutes. So I just hope that we'll all keep that in mind and try to keep as much of this exchange going on as possible in the last 10 minutes.
Okay, you ask a very interesting question and a good question. It's one I haven't thought about. And the question is, I think your question leads into a kind of new argument for evil against the benevolence of the Creator. God seemingly arbitrarily chose human beings to invest with souls, to create in his image. The other animals he didn't. What are the consequences? Well, human beings, he can command to regulate their activity with respect to each other in a way that might limit the amount of pain and suffering they cause each other. But he didn't give those capacities, he didn't give the soul, he didn't give those capacities to animals, to sharks. So they're just ripping each other to shreds, causing each other enormous pain. And apparently, God isn't concerned about that. It may be beautiful, but it's painful. It's painful to be not a human.
Okay, Dr. Antony, you said in your concluding statement that in a world without divine redemption or intervention, certain acts that we all think are unforgivable would be even worse because we'd have to live with it without God intervening. Now, what do you make of the Christian doctrine that we are all so flawed that we've all done unforgivable things, seemingly unforgivable things. Like, for instance, I bought this shirt knowing full well that it caused immeasurable pain in a third world country. So, like, and we all do stuff like that. So do you disagree with that idea that we are all so horribly flawed? If so, why? And, or do you agree with it? And if so, then how can you live with yourself in a world where there's no atonement or grace?
Well, I didn't say there's no atonement or grace. I think there is. I think that, I think you can atone for things by trying to make up for the damage or repair the damage you've done. It's just, I think it has to be done here. I really reject and find offensive the view that there are no moral distinctions to be made, and I don't believe you don't, if you will pardon my being personal, but I don't believe you believe it either. You think that you are the moral equivalent of Adolf Hitler or Pol Pot? I don't. I think there are worse, and there are worse things and worse things. I mean, I think there are lots of things. Of course, we all do things for which we are sorry and we regret. We try to do better, but there are some things that are really, really, really awful. And I think there are moral distinctions to be made. And if your religious view is that they're not, I think that's a really good reputation for your religious view.
It'll be very quick because my question's already been answered. I was going to speak about Dr. Anthony's comments about intrinsic value for evil and for good. And I was going to voice it in the question about God permitting genocide and people being, children being killed. I'll look at number 16 on your website. Just want to make an editorial comment. You do have a friend because I fully recognize that the heavens do declare the glory of God.
Our moderator, in his introduction, raised the question, like, why do we owe posterity anything? You frequently said that, like, sentient beings have a duty and a moral duty not to cause others pain. Future generations don't exist, and so they don't feel pain. So, like, what and why do we have a responsibility towards them?
Well, we have a responsibility toward we have responsibilities toward the people who are here. And some of those people are people who are going to have children. We want the people that are here to have the kind of world that will allow them to lead fulfilling lives.
So it's for the sake of the present generation and not for the sake of the future generations that we have a moral obligation?
Well, it's an interesting question, sort of what the ontology of obligation is. I think the duties that we have to current generations are certainly enough.
Just as a general question, would you agree that the morality that God gave humanity is unchanging and everlasting?
Not necessarily. I do agree with what Dr. Anthony said when she said that some moral obligations, I think, could be contingent. For example, God, I think, gave certain moral commands to Israel in the Old Testament that were temporary and not permanent. And so it does seem to me that it's within God's prerogative to do that sort of thing. But when we're talking about these really fundamental moral goods, like the intrinsic value of human beings, then I think those are certainly metaphysically necessary truths and would be unchangeable.
Well, I feel like in this conversation that everyone here has been ignoring the institutions in which people praise, worship, and preach the word of God. And I feel like these institutions have, over time, changed their own morality, such as like the Christian Crusades, and the Vatican's approval of Nazi Germany, and now more fundamental Islamic extremism.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like, therefore, would it be true that instead of an existing God and his morals, that these institutions were created as a form of social control, and that these morals were created to control the population instead of a God preaching these morals to the people?
Well, it doesn't follow that they were created for that purpose, but it certainly may well be true that they serve that function of social control and manipulation of populations and so forth. I think a very good case could be made out for that. I don't think anything follows from what you've said about the subject of tonight's debate, because Dr. Antonin and I would both agree that we can make moral mistakes, and that therefore, for example, if the church thought that the Crusades was something that was morally right and good, that they were simply wrong in thinking that. If there were theists who were guards at Auschwitz, they were just morally mistaken. So I agree with what Dr. Anthony said when she said, I don't care if my culture says something is morally permissible, and I know that it's not. My culture is simply wrong in that case. So those institutions may have served the function on occasion of social manipulation or control, but that doesn't follow that God doesn't exist, or that he's not the foundation for morality, or that there aren't objective moral truths.
And I apologize, but this is the last question.
So picking up on that comment, it seems you both agree that there's moral objectives, and Dr. Craig wonders how Dr. Anthony can hold to them without belief in God. And my question for Dr. Anthony is, notwithstanding your questions, and you raise some important questions and deep issues from the biblical record, but is it possible, how would you respond to the possibility that being made in the image of God, though you at present have issues with God, you still have that inherent sense of morality and what some things are just wrong and some things are just right as a reflection of being created in the image of God?
I suppose it's possible. It seems to me extremely unlikely that's where I came from.
think I probably evolved. And if I could just take the opportunity to say something about why I think Dawkins and Blooms are wrong, and why Dr. Craig is wrong. Dawkins persistently confuses a matter about what is essentially an evolutionary filter, survival of the fittest, right? All survival of the fittest says is there are conditions such that if you don't meet these conditions, you're not going to survive. Whatever falls through, whatever survives, that is ipso facto the fittest. That he confuses with the question of what actually motivates individual intentional creatures. It can evolve that you are a creature who has intentions that are very different from anything to do with the conditions that make it possible, the conditions that structure your ability to pass on your genes. So there's nothing in me that wants, that is aiming to maximize the number of copies of my genes in the world. God forbid I should do that. That would be, you know, I don't want that many children, right? So that's the conflation. So the idea that all we have to work with is survival of the fittest is just a fallacy. That said, there are lots of possible stories. It's not the only right story, but it seems to me the most plausible one.
Let me simply say that it seems to me that if there are these objective moral truths and principles on realism, such as Dr. Anthony and I think they are, that it is extraordinarily improbable in the extreme that the evolutionary process would produce by survival of the fittest just those beings that happen to have the correct moral perceptions and intuitions of those moral truths and values, which are causally unconnected to the evolutionary process. And that's why I think, given the evolutionary story, it's just highly, highly improbable that what we grasp onto would be objective values and truths.
I think it's highly probable. The probability is one. Here we are.
We have, throughout the course of the evening, referred to Dr. Craig and Dr. Anthony, but I think now it's time to say that Bill and Louise have certainly enlightened the public discourse tonight and that we have been the beneficiaries, and I hope you'll join me in thanking them.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org.